This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, my name is Nathan Hobson, and I'm a host for the New Books in Japanese Studies podcast, a member of the New Books Network. Today, I'll be talking with Jonathan Abel about his book, The New Real, Media and Mimesis in Japan, From Stereographs to Emoji. The book is out from the University of Minnesota Press in 2023. It's a history of our relationships to new media. The book centers on different modalities of mimesis and mediation and more as it explores the important transformation of new media into the new real. Abel describes this new real as the phase when the newer, better, faster, more realistic media of marketing hype becomes absorbed into the fabric of society and daily life. The New Real uses diverse case studies from over a century of modern Japanese history, including stereoscopic photographs, the phonograph, television, video games, even emoji, to explore the social effects of this new real. Okay, Dr. Abel, John, welcome to the podcast. So we're going to be talking about your book, The New Real, Media and Mimesis in Japan, From Stereographs to Emoji. So tell us how you got interested in the project that became this book, The New Real.
It's a long and circuitous path to this book, but I first started, thinking about questions of media in Japan a long time ago. Before I went to grad school, I spent 3 years making Japanese TV commercials in New York, which is basically producing short 35 millimeter films, at a high budget. And that was sort of my first interaction with the Japanese media world. And then kind of been teaching film in various ways ever since. And so ever since grad school, I think my second year in grad school, I taught a course that they needed a adjunct fill-in at Rutgers University. And I taught film there for a semester, and I've been teaching film almost every other year since then. And that's many, many, many years ago. So film was sort of one of my ways into questions of media, for sure. And I'm also an avid photographer, which I think gives me a kind of different purchase than a lot of people. I probably, as you gathered from the book, play video games and things like that. So I have various kind of interests that intersect with things that pop up in the book. I first thought that this book would be primarily on copyright, which became the second chapter of the book. But after my first book, which is on censorship, I thought the inverse of censorship was to deal with copyright issues. So censorship kind of is thought to restrict production, and copyright's thought to protect it. I thought these were kind of two interesting inverse projects. But I was coming at it from a literature standpoint, and what I realized about literary copyright was there weren't a lot of interesting cases. And I think part of that has to do with the amount of capital required to create literature. Usually it's one person sitting alone in a room in the standard model of creating literature, you know, writing with a brush or a pen or something. And it changes with big media or expensive media like records and film, where A, translation isn't required to know if you violated my copyright. I don't have to understand your language. I can see it or hear it. And that kind of instant apprehension is something people talk about in those court cases. So I became more interested in media through that lens as well, sort of intellectually, as I was thinking about a book on copyright. And that's kind of the genesis for a lot of the stuff in the book.
Yeah, and that's interesting. I think a lot of people will pick up on, as you said, not just that you are a video gamer, but also that you have this sort of intimate relationship with the, with much of the media that you're talking about. So this is a really ambitious book. So I want to sort of jump into it, make sure we have plenty of time to talk about it. You know, and ambitious in the sense, not just sort of theoretically, but also in the scope of what you're doing. You're sort of looking at a century and a half of these very disparate case studies, probing different angles of the question of sort of how media both represent and shape the worlds we live in and the worlds we imagine. And these are obviously Japan-based case studies. They're rooted in Japan, but specifically they're really keying in on this idea of new media, which you have referenced in the title, right? The new real media and mimesis. So with that in mind, I'd like it if we could start by asking you to unpack the following quote, which is in your introduction. So you write, "When a new medium has become quotidian and unremarkable, even boring, and we are ready for yet another next new thing, the new real arrives, our lives having been transformed through the social absorption of the no longer new medium." So when I read that, it seemed like it was a setup for a lot of the things that you're thinking about in the book, specifically the sort of the temporality, the newness of new media and the media life cycles, the life cycles of their epiphenomena, their influence, that make them into that sort of no longer new media that you reference here. So I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit, respond to that, and do that sort of in the context of the theoretical stakes and positions that you're laying out in this book, starting with chapter one.
Sure. It's a very big question, so I might take some time to answer it. So I guess new media, you know, it's a funny term, and it's been studied by a lot more people than I have, and historicized and such. People are interested. They, you know, scholars like Lisa Geidelman have done better jobs than I do in the book, specifically about the kind of always already new media. But I can give you a little context where I'm coming from with the statement that you quote, and then talk about what it means for the book, and then kind of lay out what I do in that first chapter to kind of respond to this problematic. So one of the things that's not in the book, and I think it's great to have this kind of forum to talk about the stuff that's not in the book, but that kind of helps understand the book. Maybe it should have been in the book. My academic and theoretical philosophical grounding comes from literary and art theory and history. And for a long time, like, I've had this kind of curiosity about or problem with how the strangeness I find myself when I'm reading cultural history. I find the kind of repetition, and this includes media history as well, how histories of realism end up seeming kind of cyclical. And that is, you get this kind of early moment in the history of realism where there's some sort of stylistic or technological breakthrough. And then all of a sudden people think, wow, this is it. We're really getting something here, something that feels new. And the artwork and technology then kind of sits around, and people copy it and things like this after a while. And we start to get bored with it, right? It starts to seem samey. And then we crave another kind of stylistic or technological breakthrough, rinse, repeat, we get this kind of cycle going. And this makes sense to me. It makes the new seem kind of more relevant to our world. And it makes it seem unprecedented at that first moment, that early moment of kind of the adoption of the new style and new technology. And we can see this makes sense to me of like the histories of romanticism to new realism, to social realism, to cinema verite, but also like our fascination with our gadgets, like hi-fi, high resolution, more megapixels, dial-up, DSL, cable, broadband, and now VR, AR, AI. So like this kind of like intense seeking of what media studies people call immediacy, the kind of immediate connection to the real world. And so what this means, what this kind of cycle to me means is that we have to take any claims by marketing and media studies scholars about newness of media with kind of multiple and huge grains of salt and kind of see them as simply historically ignorant of cases of presentism, right? Where it's you have to kind of forget everything that's come before and if you're going to believe these the hype of the more megapixels, right? Of the faster connection. And yet they're not completely wrong. We always, the fact is something does kind of feel a little bit different once we have the more megapixels and the photos do look a little bit different, or the connection does seem a little bit faster. And now I can see a little bit more of, the sweat on beads on, Robert De Niro's head when I'm watching a movie that I never noticed that before. Anyway, and this kind of gets at something that dropped out actually in the editing process of the book. An original subtitle of the book was Media Marketing Mimesis Made in Japan. So that marketing term, right? But that kind of marketing of immediacy to us is something that is in the book. It's kind of just dropped out of what we were foregrounding in the subtitle. So what the book then suggests again and again through its case studies is that once our desires have been thwarted, once we kind of get to that point of being like, wait, I have to buy a new camera again? I have to upgrade my iPhone just because of the camera, whatever. The desire that... that were peaked for this kind of immediacy through these marketing schemes. Once we realize that is just like, chasing flying pigs or golden calves or whatever, it's at that moment typically that we can see a more mundane mode of use of those technologies, right? So it's at the moment where people are kind of like fine with fewer megapixels, slower connections to the internet. Oh, I just need to use the internet for email. I don't really need to stream video. Give me the less broadband. A medium band is just fine for me. I'll pay for that package. And kind of at that moment, that's when the new media, I argue, kind of have become part of everyday life. That's the moment of the new real that I'm trying to articulate in this book. There's this case that I talk about in that chapter one of Nipper the Victor talking dog. It's the image that everyone's seen of the dog standing before the new medium of the phonograph, kind of tilting his head, seeming a little bit perplexed at hearing his master's voice. And we can kind of relate to that image, and people do relate to that image. I think that we feel kind of simpatico towards that image. And the book kind of narrates these moments again and again of encounter with our new media from that Victor talking dog all the way through, sitting on our toilets with our cell phones and writing poop emojis. Fundamentally, the world hasn't been changed in the way that marketing and media studies want to kind of push out to us that it has, but rather we've kind of adapted and adopted the media into our kind of routine lives. We start to kind of mimic what we see in those spaces. And this gets at the last bit of your question, which I think was moving towards the question of hypermediation. So I talked a little bit about immediacy, but the new realist kind of pushes towards hypermediation or hypermediacy. And I try to lay out in that first chapter a kind of doubled understanding of mimesis that pervades scholarship. The book describes two modes of mimesis that have existed as definitions of the term since at least its ancient Greek origins and still carry a significant weight in the humanities. And I want to talk about them kind of in a three-part order. These I'll talk about the two forms of mimesis, and then this third form, which is what I'm calling the new real. And I don't mean to say that there's a history here, that one comes before the other, but I think it's easier to kind of talk about them in an order. So on the one hand, there's this what I'll call mimesis one, but that's not because it comes before, but because it's closer to me as a scholar of literature. And this is the kind of understanding of mimesis as representational, that is, as something that is like a mirror that represents the world, right? That reflects the world. And it's akin to what media theorists talk about when they talk about immediacy, that is, you know, we have a kind of better reflection of the world. But on the other hand, there's this kind of other mimesis, I'll call it mimesis two, a kind that I think is more often discussed in like anthropology or ethnomusicology, where you're talking about mimicry, and it's usually mimicry of humans, of other humans, and bodies of other bodies, where a human copies another human, or an artwork mimics another artwork. And media studies in recent years has talked about this in terms of like remediation. Right, so the idea of one media picking up something that is common in another medium. So you can think about a digital book in which there's kind of a page flip, a page turn, right? Or even sometimes in old-timey movies, you get that kind of page turn or chapter two, or kind of shows up on the screen. So that a kind of remediation of one medium into another medium. Now, the book recognizes both of these modes of mimesis, both that is representational, copying the world, and mimicry, copying another copy, as kind of in tension with each other. So, as I said before, they're kind of, it's a modal understanding rather than a kind of historical one. That is, at a given moment or a given work, you might think of one as more salient than the other, but the other is also kind of always present. And what I try to put forth is the kind of third possibility that might explain this tension or name this tension, and I call that the new real. And that recognizes that these distinctions are not really as clear as these disciplines like literature and anthropology or something have made them out. In other words, once we recognize that the only way we copy the world, right, in mimesis one, the only way we represent the world is in a medium, then we recognize that we're kind of already always in mimesis two, because the medium then is already parts of genre, parts of language, parts of things that are copying other copies. And so mimesis one is something of a kind of mythological position, because we can't really copy the world directly. It's always mediated. And therefore, we're always sort of in mimesis two, and yet we can kind of think about mimesis one, that is, we can think about copying. So this sort of tension still seems to hold. And we can best see this, I argue, in moments of hypermediation, where a medium kind of mediates itself, where, you know, we have a book about a book, or we have a film about a film, right? So those sorts of moments really kind of help us see this tension in process. Because it refers back to our own consumption moment, and how it kind of gives a theory of how we ourselves are consuming the very thing that we're consuming in that moment that we're reading about the book about the book, right? So that's hypermediation. So I'll leave it there.
Yeah,
sorry, it's a long-winded answer to
no, not at all. It was a long answer, but it was also barely enough to sort of fit it all in there, because it is actually quite complicated. And as you point out, there's you know, a really interesting tension in the book, not just between these two types of mimesis that you talk about, and then hypermediation, but also the tension with the desire for immediacy, for not having mediation, for not having mimesis, that really, it's laid out very clearly in the answer that you just gave, and it really drives through the whole book. It also sets up very nicely what to me I think is usefully seen as kind of a unit, chapters 2 through 4, which explore different aspects of these different types of mimesis and mediation. And so you're building on the conversation we've just been having, looking at the interplay of representation and mimicry in new media. And you talk about how this could create the conditions for stereography and stereomimesis. And I'd love it if you could flesh those terms out for us, camouflage and copyright. And then also, and this is sort of provocative and I thought interesting, how you say that, quote, the copycat might reveal the medium mimesis nexus. And I wonder if maybe we could start to jump into this kind of unit here through the case study that you use in chapter 4, which is a TV series. The English translation of the title you give is Moonlight Mask, Gekko Kamen, for those of us who know it from Japanese. And it kind of anchors, I think, or at least can serve as an anchor to the conversation. So can you tell us about Moonlight Mask, about Gekko Kamen, and how you've used that in your book to sort of bring these concepts out and flesh out your argument?
Sure. So Gekko Kamen is a really kind of interesting example for me, because it's the first post-war television superhero that looks like a lot of the contemporary Japanese television superheroes. So things like Kamen Rider. Gekko Kamen is a guy who, like tons of other heroes, rides a motorcycle in Japan and wears a mask. But he himself though he's the first, he's also a copy. He's a copy of Tani Yutaka, who they also made after Gekko Kamen got canceled, another television show about Hari Mao. Tani Yutaka wore a turban and fought for justice against British imperialism. At least that's the legend in the Japanese wartime imaginary. Is a Japanese guy living in Malay, sort of a guerrilla fighter. And to some extent, Gekko Kamen, the hero, kind of invokes Tani. But at the same time, he's also the product of a direct scheme in Japanese early television to come up with content that looked something like The Lone Ranger and Superman, which had been airing on Japanese television. So he's a copy in kind of two directions, a nativist or his nationalist imaginary one, but also this kind of international global copy of a new media, or localization, right, of this new form. So it's interesting in that sense, right? It's copying the real world, but it's also copying copies, right? In the sense of the two mimeses that I just outlined. And at the same time, it leads to this kind of situation, I think also contemporary kind of situation, in which we have copying happening outside of the television too. That is, particularly young kids felt compelled to cosplay the hero and dress up and wear a mask. And indeed, the marketing of this superhero series produced masks in order to get kids to wear them, but also to sell vitamins primarily. But there are a bunch of other goods linked to the hero. And this ended with several kids hurting themselves and finally dying by copying his biggest super move, which was jumping down from tall places. And one child jumped from the top of an apartment building, 4 stories, and died. And the series got canceled as a result of this. So it's a kind of interesting story because of that. But it also then forever changes, or at least for a generation, changes how people I argue, saw justice itself in Japan. He's called Seigi no Mikata, this kind of ally of justice, like many Japanese TV superheroes are still called today. But there's an entire generation afterwards of artists and politicians who will call themselves at that particular moment Gekko Kamen, to say that they're taking up the cause. And sometimes it's tongue-in-cheek, but sometimes it's serious, that they can't imagine what it would be like to take up a cause of justice without thinking of this superhero, that somehow justice is otherworldly or comes kind of from this television space. And that's the kind of new real, when the medium has so affected our everyday life, right, that we really just can't even fathom something that we should be able to fathom without it, but we end up, you know, resorting to our media. And then the other two chapters you talk about, the stereoscopy chapter, which is really the first case study in the book, and historically so as well, kind of narrates a similar trajectory. As you said, these are kind of a set, these chapters. And so in that chapter, I talk about how stereoscopy was supposed to connect us to the world. That is, it was sold as a kind of armchair travel. You could sit at home in your living room and see the world, because it would be present before you, you know, pop up right in your eyes as you stared into this stereoscopic device at these photographs. So it very much was drawing on this kind of idea of representation or mirror or immediacy connecting us to the world. But in the end, when you stare at it long enough, or you kind of understand you're sitting in your living room at the same time as you're shuffling through these things, it always is a little bit fake. And sometimes as you stare at these things, a lot of media studies scholars have pointed out that the effect is of these 19th century technology, really, it doesn't feel very real after a while. That in fact, as you stare at, you know, hundreds of these things, you start to kind of see lines around the things that are supposed to pop out, and it almost feels like it's a diorama. And people have said that this is because you're looking at two 2D photographs, nothing's 3D, and so what your eyes are kind of being fooled into creating this 3D sense, but it's not quite complete. And that's why it feels kind of like a diorama. So it kind of fails, right? Eventually, but at first it may kind of, you may snap into this mode of apprehension and think, oh, this thing is present before me. And so the chapter kind of narrates that feeling, and also the way in which the photos themselves are constructed on the basis of other photos that came before. So the photo history is deeply connected. So for instance, you have 3D stereoscopic photographs taken of the Russo-Japanese War. And the guy who famously takes them studied under another photographer who took regular 2D photographs at the Sino-Japanese War. And so, you know, it's the new technology being adopted, but it's also a copy of what the old technology was doing. And then I end the chapter thinking about another use of stereoscopic photography, which is 3D printing into the world, which happens in the 1930s. This guy, Morioka Isao, develops this way of taking 360 pictures essentially around mostly people, and then basically doing 3D scanning this way by shining a thin stream of light against the figure's face usually, and taking 360 of these thin streams of light, he could then print them up and cut them out and stitch them together, and then use that as a last to make a bronze sculpture. And he created a business out of this. And it was a kind of early 3D printing, scanning and printing. And this to me kind of gives a very tangible sense of how the medium, right, can stand in our world and change us and become part of our lived experience. So it was a very kind of easy way of telling that story of the new real by ending with that in the chapter. And then the other chapter, the third chapter in this set of chapters that you're asking about, is about Miura Tamaki, who was a diva, opera diva in Japan, one of the first world-class, world-famous opera divas, who played over 2,000 performances as Madame Butterfly around the world in over 40 countries, came to be known as the most famous, the most recognizable, internationally recognizable Japanese person on the planet, more so than the emperor and the prime minister at the time. So, you know, true celebrity, early celebrity of 20th century Japan. And she was also the called the bicycling beauty, because she her father said, you can study music as long as you get there to Gaidai on your own. And so she picked up a bicycle and would cycle to Gaidai every day, and people would see her. And apparently at the time, women didn't bicycle very much. So very famous person, even in the city when she was a young woman, and then went out to the world, became this famous person, then comes back to Japan and records some smash hit records, selling over 80,000 copies of her performances of Madame Butterfly in Italian, but on Japanese record labels. And that's fine, no problem. She goes back out internationally to sing again, and then comes back a second time in the 20s and translates them into Japanese, the same songs that got her 80,000 sales. They translated, figuring they're going to make even more sales. And they get shut down by this guy, Wilhelm Plage, who's a German copyright hound for BIME, the European collective copyrights holder for artists in Europe. And this made Miura, who had met Puccini, who Puccini himself said, you are my ideal Madame Butterfly, kind of scratch her head and think, what's going on here? Why would Puccini's heir, who I met, who I remember driving me from the train station to Puccini's mansion in his car, why would he be suing me for money while I'm singing the songs that I've always sung? She couldn't figure it out. And eventually, during this time, the Japanese culture industry is also scratching its head at Plage, who had basically, in something they call the whirlwind of Plage storm, he basically managed in this whirlwind storm to shut down the culture industry, the music culture industry, from playing European records at all on the radio. So NHK for a period of about 6 months isn't playing anything, because he's lodging so many fines and complaints and suits against them. And so they're getting frustrated. They start binding together and thinking about how they can control this situation, which is kind of getting out of hand in their minds. And during that time, Miura is asked by a small filmmaker who's a dentist, who is doing a small short cut paper film animation, just about a 15-minute film, to sing Madame Butterfly as the soundtrack for the film. And she does that, but then they realize that they might get in trouble, and the film may never be able to be shown because of it. So she writes her own version of Madame Butterfly for this film. So the copyright kind of creates, the copyright issues kind of create the need for her to be more creative and to come up with something else. And she does so. And so I kind of look at this as a moment in which in the first instance, Miura kind of taking on this role of becoming the perfect Madame Butterfly is kind of Mimesis One, where she is stepping into this role, but it's also really Mimesis Two, because it's the role is this kind of stereotype, right? It's literally the most stereotypical view of a Japanese woman possible. But she takes this on kind of consciously, becomes a Madame Butterfly for all intents and purposes, and then that kind of slows down and becomes boring, you could say. And she then produces something else in that other moment. And that's kind of what this chapter does. But again, it leaves us with the way in which this whole kind of a series of episodes with Plage changed Japanese copyright law forever, creating JASRAC, the the law system and that produces the Japanese national rights holding conglomerate in Japan, which is called JASROC. In other words, to get rid of PLOG, they decided they had to have their own national rights holding entity, and that no foreign nationals could do so in within Japan. And that's still the case largely for copyright today.
Yeah, and I think that for me, this was sort of interesting to think about copyright in terms of in these national terms, which is not at all how I think I had considered them until now. So that was really interesting. And I also, on a personal note, I found it reading through chapter four, the Moonlight Mask chapter, thinking, you know, about conversations I've had with friends of mine, mostly, but not exclusively Japanese, where you'll find somebody in the conversation saying, "Oh, it's like a Ghibli movie," or like, "Oh, this is, you know, I feel like we're in a Disney film," or something like that. And it's that sort of feeling of like, I'm not sure which side of the mirror I'm really on here. And that sort of disorientation, which comes through these refracted mimesis and hypermediacy, that sort of drew me to that chapter as a way to jump into that. But it's also it's an interesting sort of segue into the next chapter, which is chapter five, which is about games as media, because, you know, of course, games are kind of they're the almighty media. They're everything, right? You have cutscenes, which are full movies at this point. You have, you know, interactive media. You have it's audio, it's visual, it's, you know, to some extent tactile now with the haptic controls and whatever. So I think this is a really interesting way to think about that feeling of like, am I part of this? Is it part of me? Where are we? That kind of disorientation. And so in this chapter, you give a sort of a prehistory, I guess, first to start out, playing with this idea of interpassivity. But then you dive specifically into a case study of a game called Steins Gate and its aesthetics of stereomimesis and the resulting hypermediacy that we've been talking about. And you write that, quote, "As a game that can hardly be considered a game, Steins Gate illuminates the gray area between concepts such as narrative, play, and reality." So what do you mean by that? And how does this ungame-like game accomplish this very sort of strange task that you're attributing to it?
Right. Well, I guess I should start by saying that there's a, you know, for people who aren't aware of this, there's an entire genre of game in Japan, which is more like a novel than a game. It's called a visual game novel. And that's one of these, you know, I chose one of these as the thing to write about. Basically, the way you play is to read, and it sort of cuts against all the game theory that we know, which, you know, basically typically makes the argument that, you know, to build a world that feels like a world in game space, it has to be interactive, it has to be immersive, it has to have more megapixels, right? It has to have that kind of sense. But with this form, it kind of cuts against that because it's so, so different from that in the sense that you're reading just a lot. It's a lot of reading. But maybe, you know, it's the same in the sense that, you know, it's old school immersion. You know, it's you're getting immersed in the words and the world that way. So what I'm suggesting, though, in the chapter is that maybe these kinds of games suggest that the opposite of immersion might be true, that it's not about interactivity. It's about interpassivity. It's about our ability to kind of sit back and passively watch as someone else plays for us. That might be the ultimate way of actually being immersed or actually forming this world. And so Steins Gate, you have a kind of interesting character who has, you know, discovered a way of using his cell phone to, spoiler alert, to time travel. And he uses it to save his friends from being killed. Right, typical thing of trying, like a friend gets killed and he tries to go back in time to undo the timeline that had led to that friend's killed. But each time he resets to a particular day, a different friend ends up getting killed until finally he finds the right one, but I won't get into too many of the details. But the key for the narrative and for our gameplay is that he remembers the other failed timelines. He has this kind of parallel to our playing of a game. That is, they're making our external game experience of playing an avatar of dies in the game, right? Normally we play, I don't know, Pac-Man, right? And Pac-Man dies and we learn, okay, don't go that direction when the ghost does whatever, go the other direction. And then we play again, a new life, right? Here, the character himself continues to live and remembers each different playthrough, each different timeline. And what I say, you know, this is what's called the metagame, is becomes part of the game, right? That we are now observing the avatar play basically his life as a game that he can play again and again using his cell phone to reset. And just as we learn the experiences of the avatars that we've, you know, played time and time again in a video game, he's learning in front of our eyes. And I argue it's the kind of the inclusion of this metagame-like experience within the narrative of the game itself, through, and that's the mechanism through which the game becomes interpassive. Right. That is, we're able to kind of step back to a different level. But at the same time, as we do that, the fan base around this game was hyper involved. There was a whole new kind of, or maybe not even new, but a whole ramped up metagame like experience, including the selling of this game, where they actually built a crashed satellite looking thing into the top of the Rajikan in Akihabara, which is a scene in the game itself. So they sort of built this physical real thing in the real world to sell the game. There are maps sold in Akihabara where you could go in and do your pilgrimage to the sites from the game in the real world. And there are, I talk about playthroughs, these reality playthroughs where people are posting online their experience of playing the game. And this is nothing unique. I mean, this is done pretty much for every game that has any success nowadays. But I argue it's this, the once you put the metagame into the game itself, that these things outside that's get enriched. That is, there's a new metagame to be experienced and to be thought about outside of that. So I say the gaming that that's internalized in the narrative makes the world, and here's where the theory of mimesis comes back, ecomimetically constructed. So to build a world is called ecomimesis, and this is the way in which that's done. And this is a great example, or maybe the best example in the book of hypermediation that I'm talking about, because you have multiple moments in which the character himself directly addresses you as the player of him or reader of him. And in a certain way, it takes on a certain kind of reality because it's sort of addressing or trying to scratch at the you know, the fourth wall in some way. And in those moments, we really kind of get a sense of what I argue is the new real and how it kind of breaks down.
And I think, you know, there's probably some folks listening to this who are thinking about the sort of relationship of a game like this to things like augmented reality, AR, on the one hand, where you have a great photograph in the book of the spaceship crashed into the Rajikan in Akihabara, but also things like you know, thinking about interpassivity and about thinking about game streaming, right? And where you're not actually playing the game, you're watching someone else play. And so there's, you know, Steins Gate is not either of those things in the sort of way that we think about like a Pokemon Go as being augmented reality. And it's not Twitch in terms of you're just streaming. But at the same time, you know, there is there are elements of that that are coming through. And also that sort of weird fourth wall breaking quality that that it has, where you get addressed by the character. So I think it's a really interesting example of a lot of sort of different things that are happening in other game spaces, right? Whether they be on-screen game spaces or off-screen game spaces. Yeah,
for me, this really became crystallized at one moment when I started getting bored of hitting the same button again and again to turn the page, essentially. When I was playing, the playthrough takes something like 30 or 40 hours, right, of reading, right? I say at some point, you know, there's more text in this than than 10 Soseki's Kokoros. So it's quite a long, you know, novel in that sense. Anyway, I'm getting bored of hitting play, hitting the advance button, which is basically the main way that you play the game, right? It's the advance button. That's the embodied thing. So there's a mode on most of these kinds of games that you can hit an auto button, and it will just basically scroll for you, right? It's like auto read. You know, some readers have this now. I use an app on my phone when I'm reading a long PDF, and it'll just kind of keep scrolling for you if you read at a certain rate. So it's basically that, right? And I started thinking, what's the difference between this and just watching a playthrough video on YouTube of the same thing, right? Is there a difference? And those sorts of questions came up again and again as I was kind of doing the research for this chapter. Of I kept finding these the kind of repetition of these things in different spaces. So that became part of the argument of the chapter as well.
Yeah, and I guess that also gets to one other thing that really struck me about the chapter, which is that it's a return of linearity in a medium gaming specifically, which has become less and less linear over time, right? Sandbox games and these sort of undirected open space game, you know, types of play have become the norm. And I haven't played Steins Gate, but I imagine it would be a very strange experience to be sort of stuck back in this excruciatingly linear model of production. Yeah,
I kind of went for this game because it's so old school in that way that you could really map it out. I think Mary Laura Ryan maps out in one of her books the eight different paths for video game narrative structures. And this is like one of the most simple ones. It's basically like a forking path that repeats, you know, so there's six pathways that you can go on, and it just goes back. So it's one of the most simple things. And I thought, if I could just understand this one simple thing, maybe I'll get some deeper insight into these other more complex, sandbox type games where you're free to do anything or virtually anything, right?
Yeah, it's kind of a choose your own adventure book,
yes,
right?
Yeah,
from back
exactly.
In like the early 80s. Yeah, yeah, I mean, right. I couldn't help but relate
choice.
To that.
Yeah, but with even less choice than a choose your own adventure. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Don't choose your own adventure.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so you have some choices in this game. Like you can choose whether or not and when to read certain emails on your cell phone. You have access to the main character's cell phone and things like this. But it's really, there's very little play in that in any sense. As I say in this, but that's sort of what makes it interesting to me is that it can continue to be popular in, you know, the 2000s. It's not like this is super old game at this point, but it still carries a lot of interesting questions for contemporary gaming, for questions of augmented reality. And virtual reality as well.
Yeah, and I think it also embodies that thing that you were talking about very early on, which is what happens when the new real is no longer new, right? When it becomes when you, as you said, you know, take a step back and say, well, I actually don't need that many megapixels. I don't need that download speed. I don't need the whatever the new thing is in gaming, that you're actually sort of, in a sense, taking a step back. I mean, that's the wrong way maybe to phrase it, but that says something about what games are as a medium. So I thought that was really an interesting way to illustrate that point. So this takes us to our last chapter. And I have to say, this is a little bit of a jump, at least for me as a reader. It was a leap away from some of the themes that we had been talking about, because you're talking about MLG. And you're taking them very seriously as a new medium. And I certainly understand that feeling of like they are the no longer new real medium that we've been talking about, but they're quite different sort of in their character, right? And so this means you have to grapple with some really sort of interesting questions in thinking about emoji, about their cultural and material embeddedness. And you talk about them as sort of contingent symbols with universalist pretensions, and how the no longer realness of them, right? The fact that they become a part of the fabric of everyday life, what that has meant to us as users, as consumers of them, about discourses of race, techno-orientalism, et cetera, in the humdrum of the new media. And at the same time, you also point out that emoji have this, and I want to quote you here, integrative as well as sinister impacts as part of the fabric of society. So I'd like if you could sort of maybe start with that as a way to unravel what it is about emoji that interested you.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you found the chapter interesting. In a way, it was one of the more difficult ones to write because it's so ready to hand, because it's so part of our everyday lives. Maybe the best thing here is to take a minute and expand on the phrase you quoted, integrative as well as sinister impacts. So in a way, emoji stage the problem not so much with media, but with communication itself. I think what a sign means to me, it might not mean to you, right? And because these signs seem so iconic, seem abstract and free of detail on the surface, right? They're just these like little pictures, right? Very clean pictures. In contemporary discourse, they have been, in a sense, kind of saturated in meaning, but also free and saturated in the medium itself, thought of as kind of free, and which is thought of as helping us to communicate better. Free and frictionless communication is something that comes up a lot, where you know it's difficult to people say it's difficult to express emotion in a text, but you know you can do it with emoji. And this is sort of one of the misunderstandings of emoji, that people often equate it with emoticons. It sounds similar in English, emoticon and emoji, but they have kind of different lineages. Emoji literally in Japanese means picture character, or pictograph, where emoticon is an Englishism that comes from emotion and icon, right? So there's this, it's more like a fancy convergent of cultures, where the emoticons kind of came around first. And then when emoji came out, they had that to go on as something that they needed to remediate. That is, these smiley faces that people were doing with, you know, their slashes and their parentheses and things like this would now be translated into yellow have a nice day faces and things like this in the emoji world. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's enabling more frictionless and free communication, because what these things mean in different places and to different people of different skin tones and things like this means something different. And so I got into thinking about the rhetoric of this kind of free universal language that pictographs often are associated with, and the reality of the different usages and local usages of emoji. So we can say, in a sense, the free and frictionless kind of argument is one of immediacy, right? This sort of representation or connecting something with the world, solving a problem in the world, getting us to communicate better, right? Bringing us closer together, making us more immediate to one another. But pretty soon, we actually kind of see how using emoji works or doesn't work. You start to notice failures of the aspirational universal language everywhere. I don't know if you know the H building in the initial emoji set. There's a building with a big H on it and a heart.
No, I don't think I do.
So this is, you ask most people around the world, what do you think this is? And most people around the world say, oh, it must be a hospital.
Yeah, no, because I don't think it is.
But it is, right? Is it, right? Yeah. Anyone who knows Japanese culture thinks about it for a minute and says, oh, right, it's a love hotel, an hourly hotel that young people often who live at home with their family have no space for hooking up. They go to the hourly love hotel to do their business. But the way we use emoji, like the rest of language, is not only cultural, it's highly idiosyncratic. So people still use it as a hotel, but also some people use it as a hospital, depending on where you see it. This is what makes, you know, meeting someone new who uses emoji differently than you, kind of frustrating, but also exciting, right? You thrill when you see different kind of quirky uses. And because we have to kind of learn to understand people on their own terms through this weird interface of mediation that is now on most phones everywhere. That's connected also, though, to mediations we've experienced with our bodies. In many of these, it's emoji. It's not just infrastructure like a love hotel or cars and trains and things like this, but it's particularly related to our body, probably because of that initial emoticon connection where people were thinking about this as a gap of text, of fast communication with text and things like this in the late 90s when these were first adopted. And I focus in this chapter then particularly on the poop emoji, because it seems at first like so clear that this is a universal, right? It's clearly poop. We all poop. It should be just fine to think of it in that way. But it really isn't one. The anthropomorphic swirly poop that is highly specific in its origin from a manga, and it has a specific set of meanings there. And people around the world have misapprehended it as things like soft serve ice cream. Because sometimes it shows up as being pink in color, or yellow even, depending on what phone interface you're using. So ultimately, the poop is not a kind of universal humanism, a kind of free and frictionless way of communicating, but it serves to remind us of something else. And I first thought of this actually in a totally different context. I was reading a novel by the author of Ring, Koji Suzuki. He wrote, he loves media and always is writing about media. So Ring is about videotapes, right? But this novel that I was reading, it was called Drop. And it's a short novel written on toilet paper rolls. So you buy 3 toilet paper rolls and presumably read this novel as you're wiping yourself. The story takes place in a toilet, in a public toilet, but it's about cell phone use in the public toilet. And so this is what sort of got me thinking about this. And it sort of connected to me stories. I had been reading about the weird scientists who go around and swab people's cell phone screens and to see what they find on them. And inevitably they find the bacteria most associated with fecal matter on people's phones, which is sort of proof of this kind of cell phone use. So ultimately, I say the reason why this emoji is so popular might not have to do with the fact that we are all humans, but rather that there's a very human kind of usage of emoji themselves, in which we're communicating sitting on our toilets, probably more than we should be. And in a way, then the book kind of moves from talking about Nipper, the Nipper dog in an Ozu film, who tilts his head at the Victor talking machine, and ends with this kind of vision of users today kind of prodding and poking this poop emoji, like the robot in Dr. Slump, the manga in which this swirly poop kind of first appeared.
Yeah, I will admit it was a little bit weird to have to take the poop emoji so seriously. but as you've explained now, it makes a lot of sense in terms of creating a kind of loop back effect to get back to some of the themes that you had been talking about. And also, it made me think of, I forget who it was that said it, but we were promised free energy and flying cars, and what we got is being able to do your taxes while you poop. Right.
Exactly.
There's a sort of dystopianness to the whole thing, which I think in a way, the poop emoji is a kind of, it's become a kind of satire of a dystopian technological present, if I may. And it's sort of interesting to see that, from the position of a media analysis, which is, looking at it in a very different way that I, sort of a more historian oriented person, have been tending to see it. So I really appreciated being able to sort of have that, the circularity, right, where you're really going back to that original theme with his master's voice. That takes us to the end of the book, but not to the end of the interview, because I did want to ask you before we go what it is that you are up to today, whether you're still thinking about poop emoji or whether you've moved on to other things, and what they are.
Yeah, well, I have moved on to other things, although maybe not so far afield. Based on one of these ideas, the sort of the final idea, this kind of third moment of living with our media and how media impacts the real world, I've been working through on another project this year. I'm a Woodrow Wilson Center scholar, fellow, I guess they call us, this year. And my project is basically working on a book on Japanese Twitter novels. So novels published in microblog format. I'm also looking a little bit at Line and Instagram novels. And I'm centering these around 3 to 5, I haven't really decided yet, different case studies. So looking at Fukushima, the rise of the Me Too movement in Japan, the cancellation of the Aichi Triennale in 2019, the decision to hold the 2020 Olympics in 2021 in Tokyo, and finally the coronavirus pandemic overall. So I'm looking at specifically at the question of how these novels, which are novels in 140 characters, very short form novels. There's also some serialized Twitter novels that I look at, but primarily I'm looking at ones that claim to be a novel in 140 characters, which is a weird format, right? They're almost more like jokes than they are novels, or poetry, some people call them. But I'm looking at the way in which these things that are overtly calling themselves fiction relate to the news cycle. And as a way to say that this is a kind of a test example of whether or not we should label fake news, because these are saying, I am fiction, I am fake to begin with at the outset. And in many cases they read like fake news does, with the difference that they announce that they are fake. So you'll have, for instance, mask denial about the coronavirus pandemic in the form of a Twitter novel coming up. And this pops into people's news feeds as they're reading Twitter, along with perhaps actual denial of wearing a mask. And the question is, does one circulate better than the other? One circulate further than the other? Does one get liked more, higher engagement rate than the other? Do they circulate in similar communities or different communities from these other tweets that look very similar? So what kind of policy recommendation might we make towards a social media site in order to deal with the problem of fake news? So that's where I am. And it comes kind of directly out of this question of questions that the New Real raises, in the sense of we're now living with this media in this kind of echo chamber where we have just copies of copies going back and forth. And And yet there seems to be the potential for these kinds of fictions to contribute to something that people have called irony poisoning, which I don't know if you've heard this term before, but I'm fascinated by it right now. And irony poisoning is basically the idea that the first time you hear a joke about something, even a caustic, sexist joke, you may chuckle at it. The hundredth or thousandth time you hear it, you might just forget the fact that it's ironic and think that it's stating something true. So the irony is poisoned out of it. You could say your ability to recognize irony is dead, right, or dying as this goes on. And I think that, you know, both fake news takes this on, but also the question of fiction actually playing a role in this kind of ideological formation, I think, is something that this study is sort of trying to gauge. And I'm doing it using both digital methods, kind of digital humanities methods, but also kind of traditional close reading methods.
Well, that sounds fascinating. And I hope that we will be able to have you back pretty soon to talk about that book. When we do, I'll be excited to have you on.
Thank you so much.
Great. Well, it was lovely to talk to you today. Take care.
It was great. Thank you.